You're listening to a news report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
Hello and welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of thebodypro.com. On December 1st, 2009, the U.S. government updated its guidelines for the use of antiretroviral agents in HIV-1-infected adults and adolescents. These guidelines were last updated on November 3rd, 2008. We asked Dr. David Wall to provide a summary of the changes. Dr. Wall is not only one of the top clinicians and researchers in the United States, he's also a guidelines panel member. Dr. Wall, can you walk us through what you think are the most important updates to the guidelines?
Thanks for having me, Bonnie. One thing I just want to clarify before we start is that I will be speaking from my personal opinion and not as a representative of the particular guidelines we're going to be talking about, but really, again, just sharing my personal perspectives regarding these guidelines. I think people should first recognize that the guidelines are important to use in a variety of different ways. The clinician who is well-versed in HIV therapy, there's a lot here that they already are aware of and know. There's a lot of background. It's a really good primer on the management of HIV. Updated perspectives about where we are with state-of-the-art of managing HIV in adults and adolescents, particularly patients who are treatment naive. A clinician who doesn't see a whole lot of HIV, I think that this is an excellent resource about the foundations of management of HIV and, in addition, references that you can use to further explore this. I often tell people, this is one of the things you should read. While it looks like a daunting document with lots of pages, half of it's references and a good proportion of it are tables. It's very, very readable, and you can pick and choose the sections that are most apropos to what your concerns and interests are. This particular revision reflects a lot that's happened in our field over the last year since we had updates to this guideline. The last full revision was about a year ago. In that time, a lot of data have come out, both in regards to when to start HIV therapy and also regarding different HIV regimens and their comparative efficacy and tolerability.
If you followed all the HIV meeting news, there's nothing surprising in this document.
I think if people are hip and wise and come to thebody.com or thebodypro.com and keep up with what's going on, there will be few big surprises here. As you see with the section on initiating HIV therapy and treatment-naive individuals, there is room for surprise here. There was an interesting recommendation here which suggests that we consider therapy at a higher CD4 cell count than we historically have done, at least more recent history. Antiretroviral therapy continues to be recommended for patients who have a CD4 cell count less than 350, or AIDS-defining illnesses or other qualifying illnesses. Now, also is recommended to be initiated. There is this interesting bullet that indicates that 55% of the panel voted for strong recommendation. That's an A rating, and while 45% voted for a moderate recommendation. There was consensus that there should be treatment recommended for patients with a T-cell count between 350 and 500, yet the strength of that recommendation was split between an A, meaning a strong recommendation, or a B, moderate. This is something that's very important in the recommendations and in the guidelines. One thing people don't always pay attention to is the rating of the recommendations and the rating of the evidence. We really do think hard about this, as do all guideline committees. A means strong, B means moderate, C means this is really up to you, it's optional. The number that comes after that, being a 1, 2, or 3, spans from 1, data from randomized controlled trials, so slam dunk, really important studies that are considered the gold standard, to 2, data from well-designed studies that are not randomized, such as observational cohorts, 3, this is just the opinion of the people on the guideline committee. For this 350 to 500, you're seeing basically this is strong to moderate in the strength of the recommendation, and it's based on 2, meaning observational data, non-randomized trials. For patients with a CD4 count above 500, the panel was evenly divided, 50-50, regarding starting therapy at this stage of disease. 50% of the people viewed initiating therapy at this stage as optional. while others felt more strongly. So you can see that B rating, where it was sort of a moderate strength, to a C, meaning it was almost optional. The data here is mostly based upon non-randomized studies, observational cohorts, and other types of studies, including pathogenesis studies. I think the biggest thing that people are going to talk about is when to start therapy, particularly in that over 500 range.
Don't you think that these recommendations could have been made easier for both clinicians and patients to understand and therefore put into practice if it did away with the rating scheme?
You want to make sure that you reflect what we know, and there are gaps in what we know. I think guidelines should reflect what is known, and then there is expert opinion. What you're seeing here is a division among experts regarding what should be done. I think that's why you see in this document a very nicely laid out argument for both why therapy should be initiated earlier and some of the concerns regarding that. I think that is a mirror to what we see clinically. We see clinicians who feel very strongly that we should do one or the other. And in the absence of data, that's not atypical. We see that all the time, whether it be should we start therapy in people with opportunistic infections, should we start with one drug versus another. Until we have data, we basically are working in a vacuum. In this case as well, we don't have as much data as we'd like. We don't have the forms of data. I think the general equipoise that we see in our treating community is well reflected in this document. But I think it allows people to start making decisions for themselves. I think you're right. This is a document that could be challenging for people to read front to back. I know that clinicians are busy, but they're schooled and can read this material. It just depends upon where they do it, when they do it, and how they do it. It's really important to read the relevant sections that you care most about that influence your practice. I don't think it would take too long for someone to read through the arguments laid out here, I think, very thoughtfully, on when to initiate therapy and even what to initiate, because both of those really influence how we practice. You can't put all the arguments and all the discussion in one gray box. I think that the words that follow help people understand and then make a decision for themselves. Guidelines could tell you exactly what to do. Where there's strong evidence, it does that. Where there's less evidence, it says this is something you have to think about. Your patient population may influence dramatically which way you go. I was in New York not too long ago, and I went to an academic medical center where discussion of starting at a higher CD4 cell count led to a lot of people saying, no way. We have a challenged patient population. It's hard enough to get people on therapy who need it with low CD4 cell counts. How are we possibly going to get people who are well and are going to be on therapy for many years to take therapy earlier? Then the next day, I was in the Bronx at a very small clinic, small in size as far as space, but sees lots of patients. And they were completely down with treating people as early as possible. They see a lot of people with early HIV infection because there's a huge testing outreach in the South Bronx. This clinic says, no, we don't wait, and we have great success in reaching out to people and making sure they stay on their medicines. Until we get more data, it's very hard for guidelines to say you should do this or you should not do this because there's harm in not doing something as well. I think that's reflected here.
I thought interesting was the comment near the conclusion of this completely revised section on starting HIV treatment that in a way all this discussion and recommendations regarding starting treatment above 500 is moot since most people are not diagnosed at anywhere near that high CD4 count.
I don't think it's moot completely. And I think what we're going to see over the next year or two or three is the diagnosis of people at higher CD4 cell counts. If the data we're seeing from the Bronx and from Washington, D.C., where there are increased efforts to test people.
Is this the test and treat program?
The test and treat. Not everyone who gets tested, even under these guidelines, would get treated. But certainly testing people, we're going to find people at higher CD4 cell counts. We certainly know that opt-out testing is becoming increasingly embraced across the country. And that took a while since the CDC's recommendations emerged at the end of 2006, but it's happening. I actually think that we are going to see more and more people diagnosed at higher CD4 cell counts, whether it be in our correctional systems, whether it be in our clinics. In our own clinic here in Chapel Hill, the median CD4 cell count at first presentation to our clinic is 300. It's no longer down in the low 200s. So we're seeing a slow creep in the CD4 cell count of people coming into clinic for the first time. That's going to continue. I don't think this is going to be moot at all in the next few years as we do more and more of this.
I talked to somebody who has been in the field for a very long time, and I said, they just changed the guidelines. And she said, oh, wasn't it starting in 500 10 years ago?
It does swing back and forth. It's ironic that we started people with a CD4 cell count of 500 years ago when we had AZT. It's like our only therapy, basically. Then when we had combination HIV therapy is when we had guidelines that indicated, based upon the available data, we should wait until a CD4 cell count of 200. We're learning, and the data are accumulating, but at the same time, our therapies are getting more advanced. If we had a perfect HIV therapy that was a pill a day, had no toxicity, resistant to resistance, and was cheap, wouldn't we be treating everyone at the get-go, like we do for almost all infectious diseases? We don't wait for an infectious disease to get worse before we generally treat it. Most of them we treat from the time of diagnosis. HIV has been exceptional because of the toxicity of the therapy and because of the issues with resistance, and it's a lifelong therapy. We've been trying to find this sweet spot at the perfect time to start therapy, to not allow there to be irreparable harm to the individual, but yet not expose them to excessive HIV therapy. I think we're getting closer to that ideal therapy. We're not obviously there yet, but we have therapies that appear to be much less toxic than what we've been dealing with in the past and are much more convenient and are more potent and resistant to resistance. Many smart people have pointed out that someone getting diagnosed now can anticipate being on therapy 30 or more years. I think that we can't minimize exposure to HIV therapy and the costs and the potential for toxicity that we don't know about. I think those are all important points that we have to consider. Even though they may not be as concrete as individuals sometimes want, I do think that laid out here is a very nice discussion pointing to the way that people should think about practicing.
Let's switch now to the initial combination regimens that are recommended. I noticed a dramatic removal of Caletra from the preferred list. It's the last of the older drugs to leave the list.
Right, and it says a lot about Caletra. This is a drug that's co-formulated, and I don't think we can minimize co-formulations and their benefit. Co-formulation has been a wonderful advance and is something that we're going to see a lot more of. Adherence has always been a problem for our populations, and co-formulation really solves a lot of problems. In this case, though, a couple of different studies show that compared to other protease inhibitor combinations, namely darunavir-ritonavir and atazanavir-ritonavir, when you look over a longer period of time, it does look like, at least statistically, people can do better overall with these alternative boosted protease inhibitors compared to lopinavir-ritonavir. I think what we're seeing here is something we in the clinic have observed, which is people do pretty well on lopinavir-ritonavir, but over time there is a fatigue factor. And we do see people trailing off of it. That may be due to the ritonavir exposure, the pill count, the side effect profile, which is a little bit rougher, even though it's not horrible, but a little bit rougher than what we see with the newcomer protease inhibitors. I do know people still cling to their co-formulated boosted PI, and I understand that. And now that we're in an era where co-pays can really determine what's the best therapy for someone, because you can have a great therapy, but if someone can't afford the co-pays and can't ingest that therapy, it does you no good. The guidelines reflect the science more so than anything else, and that's appropriate. The data that we've seen emerge from comparative studies is reflected in what the panel is recommending.
Was it any specific study during the past year that made this change happen?
Two really nice studies compared lopinavir-ritonavir with darunavir-ritonavir and with atazanavir-ritonavir. Those have now gone on for at least 96 weeks. We get to really have a nice picture when you have well-powered head-to-head studies. Early on, you see very comparable responses to both arms of these individual studies, but over time, there is this trailing off in the lopinavir-ritonavir arms of these two studies where people just don't seem to have virologic suppression, oftentimes due to tolerability issues with lopinavir-ritonavir. It's not to say that the drug doesn't perform well. It does, with over 70% of people generally still doing well at 2 years. But compared to the other two boosted protease inhibitors in these individual studies, we're seeing a little bit less of a response that's statistically significant. Clinicians have to decide for themselves whether that is clinically significant enough for them to change their practices. If you're going strictly by randomized clinical trials and the data that emerge from those, and that's something that carries a lot of weight and should carry a lot of weight, you can see that there are differences between these regimens. The tolerability issue should be emphasized. When you look at darunavir-ritonavir compared to lopinavir-ritonavir, about half the rate of GI disturbance, including diarrhea. That's significant for a lot of our patients. If you go down from 10%, which is not horrible, on lopinavir-ritonavir, to 5% with darunavir-ritonavir, for instance, that can mean a lot. It could keep some people on therapy and keep them more comfortable. I think those are the kind of data that we need. That's why we like these head-to-head studies. You don't know who's going to be better for your individual patient unless you're able to compare these side-by-side.
If someone has a patient who is on Kaletra and seems to be doing okay, is there any action required?
This always comes up when people get new data or when guidelines change. What we're talking about here is in a group of people who are just starting on therapy, what would be the best thing to start? That's a different question than someone who's on therapy and doing very well. What should you now do? For the patient who's doing very well on therapy, it's very hard to change therapy. You'd have to have a good reason. If they're having side effects, then I might say, here's an alternative for you. This might be something that would give you less side effects. Again, I don't mess too much with success unless there's a compelling reason. An example might be people who remain on therapy with Trizivir, the co-formulation of AZT, Abacavir, and 3TC. Even if they're doing well, I'm still a little uncomfortable because we know that there's late failures that do occur in that regimen compared to regimens that are including an RTI or a boosted PI. That would be an example where I would change someone. But if someone is doing really well on lopinavir-ritonavir, these data do not compel me to change, and that's not what these studies were about.
How big is the chasm between preferred and alternative?
An alternative is a therapy that should be considered, but the data, for whatever reason, whether it be efficacy or tolerability or other considerations, indicate that there may be a regimen that, all things considered, would be preferred. For an individual patient, however, it could easily be that one of the alternatives is preferred. For that individual patient who can't take, for whatever reason, one of the drugs that are listed in the quote-unquote preferred panel of drugs, an alternative may actually be preferable. A perfect example is we like, historically, to give people tenofovir and FTC. That's one of the most popular, if not the most popular, nucleoside combination to give as part of initial therapy. Abacavir 3TC is listed as an alternative. Clinically, we look at someone and say, is there any reason I shouldn't use tenofovir FTC? If there is, then I'm going to go to abacavir 3TC. The alternative is there if you can't use the preferred. So the alternatives work, but there may be individual reasons why they should or should not be used in your patients.
Let's talk about an addition to the list, the addition of the integrase inhibitor raltegravir, also known as Ascentris. Could you talk about that addition?
For many of us, the addition of another class of drugs to use in treatment-naive folks is an important one. We know well the NNRTI and boosted PI strengths and weaknesses. While this is very helpful, these combinations for our patients, there's certainly room for improvement. Having another choice helps us and gives us greater flexibility in responding to the needs of our individual patients. The integrase inhibitor raltegravir is a drug that I think has some important features. Namely, it doesn't have ritonavir and it doesn't give you bad dreams, and that says a lot for it. It is twice a day, which is a little bit of a drag on its success, I think. We're trying to keep things simple for our patients. There are data that show that the drug is very effective in treating treatment-naive folks compared to efavirenz, which is considered practically a gold standard when we're thinking about what to treat people with initially. Responses and tolerability were really great in a head-to-head comparison. This is a very good option, and there are data to support the use of the drug. There are data now enough over time that you can get a sense of its tolerability and safety. Its placement in the recommendation reflects on the data we have available right now. I think it's hard not to consider this as a first-line option alongside the boosted PI and NNRTI Favran-based regimens.
A lot of people started people on Raltegravir a while ago. I think there was such enormous excitement when it was first approved, and there was this feeling about it, I don't know if it was good data, but that it was more powerful than other drugs. Has that been borne out?
In some of the work that had been done initially with the drug and subsequently, you see really rapid virologic responses where the decay of the virus over the first couple of weeks of therapy with raltegravir is pretty dramatic. But over time, efavirenz catches up. We don't know exactly what the significance is of that for longer-term health and well-being of our patients, but I think that at least instilled this concept that this drug was potent. The data showed that it is powerful and comparable to drugs that we're using more commonly in initial therapy. It's nice to have the option. Not everyone can take a ritonavir-based regimen. Not everyone can take a efavirenz. It's nice to have something else that people can go to, and the data indicate that if someone wanted to use that preferentially, there's no reason not to. I think what you have now with these preferred regimens is a really broad panel of drugs that in clinical trials have basically shown themselves to be just as good as one another or as good as to the comparator drug that it was compared to, usually efavirenz.
What about people trying regimens that are not on this list? There are some people who feel that all the new drugs are good, so they'll throw in raltegravir, etravirine, maraviroc. Is that a good idea?
Like you said, there are people who use raltegravir commonly and have done so for the last year or so, but I think most HIV treaters are a little bit slow in adopting some of the more aggressive regimens. There is lots of room for creativity in HIV, and that's one of the things that attracts me to this field. You're not going to have every study done that compares every single regimen or even every single strategy. What we do have, and what's spelled out in the guidelines, and I think this is what's very nice about having a very complete set of guidelines that include references to data, these are the comparisons that have been made. These are the studies that have been done. Sure, there are studies that could be done or should be done, but we don't have those yet. We've been burned in the past. We've made assumptions thinking that if this works and this works, then this should work, only to find out it didn't work. I'm not saying that we have to be strictly evidence-based. Evidence-based is important. We make decisions based upon evidence, and the guidelines reflect the evidence that's available. But we all know that in clinical practice, we have to be creative. That creativity is something that I think is vital to the practice of medicine. I think something we do here in the U.S. very, very, very well. There usually has to be a reason, though, to be creative. And so if you're going to say to someone, I'm going to put you on this regimen that may be wonderful but hasn't really been studied yet because I just feel like it's going to work better for you, that may be your style, but that's not my style. I think there has to be really good reasons to do something that deviates from what's laid out here and what the data support. Now, there are special cases where you have to be flexible and you have to think on your feet. That's where that creativity and that knowledge and that extrapolation comes in handy. But you can't concoct a creative, bold regimen for a certain circumstance without understanding the fundamentals of HIV management and understanding what's given traditionally, what the data support given traditionally, and why you're deviating from them. You can throw the kitchen sink at someone, but why? We're learning more and more that some of these potent regimens are just fantastic at dropping the virus down and keeping it down. The preferred and alternative, these things work. Over 65, 70, close to 80% of people on these drugs get undetectable and stay there long term in clinical trials. I think to start mucking around and start coming up with things that are not standard, when you have all these choices, there has to be a compelling reason. You can screw people up, and we know that, and you don't want to do that. Good thing is we have new classes of drugs. We have the integrase inhibitors. We have the CCR5 antagonists. Other therapies are still coming down the pipeline. You can still hurt people. I really feel people have to be very thoughtful. Your first shot continues to be your best shot, even though we have now more bridges to build if we burn bridges. I think still you want to get someone on a good therapy initially and keep them on that for years. To start coming up with some other things, that's great in the setting of a clinical study. but I don't think is for practice. I try to treat my patients as I would want to be treated or a family member. I don't know that any of us would want to start on some kitchen sink approach. And if you do, well, then that's something you should explain to your patients.
Let's switch to the management of treatment experienced people. I noticed that having a low viral load is no longer an indication of treatment failure or reason to change treatment. Can you discuss this?
I've thought a lot about this as well clinically, because we do see people who have low levels of viremia. And the question is how aggressive to be about that. Part of the problem is when you have low-level viremia, you also don't have as much data, because you don't have the genotypic or phenotypic resistance data that can help you devise a new combination. We also see that with our current assays being highly sensitive with low limits of detection, that at least some of them, we start to see a little bit of noise, meaning we have assays now that have a huge dynamic range from a very low threshold of detection of 50 all the way up to 100,000 or more for the top threshold. And we're starting to see that some people just have low-level virus with these newer assays. We also know that people who have low-level viremia don't seem to do poorly. Certainly, resistance seems to be unusual in people with very low levels of virus. There have been studies that have tried to take people who have this low-level viremia, let's say 50 to 200, and intensify their therapy with raltegravir or fenfluvertide. And you know what? The viral load doesn't go down. If it was replicating virus, many of us feel it should have gone down when you intensify therapy with drugs that the virus should be susceptible to. Is this trafficking virus? Is this virus that's really replicating and mutating? Probably it's not the latter, and it might be the former. It doesn't necessarily indicate that there's failure going on or that you should switch therapy that is effective. I think many of us have also learned from experience that changing therapy or intensifying therapy in such patients has diminishing returns. We don't really see big changes in that low-level viremia. Low-level viremia doesn't scare me. We have to realize the limitations of our current assays. Just because an assay may not detect virus one day doesn't mean that the next day it's not 51 or 199. So that there is biological variability, and then there's lab variability. And this whole issue of virus that's flowing from different compartments. I think that the risk of resistance is very low from all the data we're seeing. If you don't have a lot of replication, you don't have a lot of chances for mutations to develop, because it's only when you have a replicative cycle that mutations can emerge and persist. So if there's such a low level of replication, the chances that there are going to be resistance is very low as well. I keep them on therapy generally, and I don't try to change their therapy and expose them to a whole new set of drugs and a new schedule, new pill count, etc.
There are very few new drugs in the pipeline for treatment-experienced patients over the next couple of years. Was anything mentioned in the guidelines about what kinds of things can be done for this population?
We really have just come from a very nice wave of the release of therapies that have given our patients a new lease on life. We have drugs now that are in new classes for which people should be fully susceptible, such as the integrase inhibitor and the CCR5 antagonist. We have drugs now that work against virus that's resistant to other members of drugs in the same class, such as etravirine in the NNRTI class, darunavir, ritonavir in the PI class. We have salvage therapies. We have drugs that can be used up front and drugs that can be used later on. I think that we have a really nice portfolio of drugs now to help people almost regardless of how much treatment experience they have. That wave of new drugs and that critical mass of new drugs that we can use together means that we can devise really good regimens even for people who are experienced and have multi-drug resistant virus. As you point out, there may be a lull for a while where we can't expect there to be great and novel new drugs, two or three at a time every year. That's asking a lot. But I do think that on the horizon, there still are some important drugs that may emerge in the existing classes. We'll see new integrase inhibitor come out with a different resistance profile that's exciting. I think we'll see other drugs come out even in different classes and new classes. I don't think that the door is shut for people. I do feel strongly that the new drugs that have come out have really benefited a tremendous number of our patients. I'm really excited about what we're seeing in clinic and how many of our patients who had few options left are doing exceedingly well. Even if they don't get the gold medal and they're undetectable, they get silver and bronze medals where their viral load is under better control, their T cell counts have gone up, they're not sick. That's a testament to the ability to combine drugs that work against people's viruses. I don't think the guidelines necessarily have the crystal ball and indicate what to do, but they do talk about strategies for trying to reduce the need to be on salvage therapy and I think help people understand what to do with the existing drugs. It's hard to predict what will come out and what will work, but we all know in this field that drugs continue to be developed and that there are clinical trials continuing to go on and even novel agents that may emerge that could help us quite a bit, just as we've seen with the integrase inhibitors and the CCR5 antagonists.
Genotypic testing is still recommended as preferred, and it's still for people who walk into the clinic and for switching regimens.
Absolutely. So all of the arguments that were made previously are still salient. I think that we get a lot of information from genotypic testing, as is outlined. A beauty of these guidelines is you can just take the bullet point home and say, well, I've got to do resistance testing here, here, and here. You can read on and understand what are the data that support that and how strong the data are. There is really good rationale that's laid out nicely in the document about why genotypic resistance testing is preferred, why we should do it early in the course of HIV disease and before we start therapy.
I noticed there was a paragraph about resistance testing for integrase and fusion inhibitor resistance and the limitations of that.
I think part of this is that this is an emerging area where we have to understand that in our standard resistance testing panel, integrase resistance is not yet included standardly. Over time, I think we will see more of this integrated into our resistance testing. We're going to have to think about integrase resistance as we use the drug more. And when additional integrase inhibitors come out, you may have to order a specialized test, a separate test at additional cost. We'll see what commercial laboratories do with this, and I expect that over time we will see barriers to getting this type of testing will be reduced.
Could you also summarize what's new for people who have both HIV and hepatitis C?
This is another area that is going to be exciting. There's a lot of research being done regarding hepatitis C, co-infection in HIV, and also in hepatitis C in general. There's limitations to the current therapy that we have, which is ribavirin and interferon. As many people are well aware, there's certainly a lot of room for therapy to be more efficacious and better tolerated. I think what we're seeing here is discussion for us to pay attention to hepatitis C co-infection and how that influences both HIV progression and how HIV influences hepatitis C. There's a lot of thought being given to the sequencing of hepatitis C and HIV therapy. Many of us feel that there's traction for an argument to be made to aggressively treat both of these infections. Treatment of HIV can perhaps improve responses to hepatitis C therapy, and we know that hepatitis C may facilitate HIV disease progression. These are two viruses that are intricately linked and have significant morbidity. We also understand that they have the risk of there being drug-related toxicities with both of these. If you treat the HIV, you may have hepatotoxicity due to the therapies we use for HIV in people with hepatitis C. Conversely, we know that we can hurt people with hepatitis C therapy and make HIV therapy toxicities worse, namely the anemias if someone's on a drug that can cause anemia like AZT. So we avoid that. We don't have a definitive study about when you should start one, when you should start another. Nice section that just details some of these considerations and what people feel based upon what we know. I think that most of us are comfortable treating hepatitis C or recommending our patients get hepatitis C therapy. The important point is, of course, first to diagnose hepatitis C, to understand the staging of hepatitis C and the things that influence whether or not to treat it. I think we've got that down pat. We've come a long way over the last few years. I think we're also becoming more comfortable with using HIV therapies in people with hepatitis C with liver dysfunction and in using hepatitis C therapies in people who are on HIV therapy. I don't think there's a lot that's bold and new. I think it's spelled out pretty nicely, some of the considerations. I think that's a nice feature in this particular version of the guidelines.
There's also an entire new section about the HIV 2 strain.
Are we seeing more HIV-2 in the United States? I know there are a lot of West African immigrants in certain states in the United States.
I don't know if we're seeing more HIV-2. If the prevalence is increasing in the United States, it may well be, given what you're talking about. But I think that it's nice to get a little bit more information about what antiretrovirals are known to work in HIV-2 and which ones seem not to work as well. And a lot of this, of course, is based upon in vitro testing. This is another one of those fields where we just don't have as much data as you think we should. You know, we don't have good viral load testing abilities for HIV-2, so that can really be a problem. How do you determine efficacy of therapy, and how do you study this? Hopefully, there will be more information coming along that help us understand how to manage this, because some of us do see this once in a while, and as you mentioned, there are people who come here from other parts of the world where HIV-2 is endemic, such as West Africa and parts of the Caribbean. I think this is a real research need. Just reading this section, you can see how limited our understanding is of how to treat HIV-2.
There was a section about positive prevention buried at the end. Could you talk a little bit about that section and what it means for an HIV specialist?
Whatever it is at the end is always talked about as being, unfortunately, at the end, but something has to be there. I think that it's really important that we think about prevention within the context of these treatment guidelines. They do a good job of trying to integrate conception of treatment as therapy and not ignoring treatment as a really important part of preventing secondary HIV transmission. That's something you see throughout the document, that there's more and more mention of that made, whether it be in the when to start therapy section or in the prevention section. I think what we're also talking about, though, is that there could be a marriage between biological interventions, namely getting someone's viral load down so that they don't transmit the virus through their semen or genital secretions, but marrying that with behavioral interventions. Something that I think is nice in this document is important references to evidence-based interventions that are adapted for clinical use that have been shown to reduce people's likelihood to transmit the virus to others. We want people to be aware of that. I think what the guidelines do is lay down a recommendation for what should be done clinically and how we should assess the risk behaviors of our patients. We should understand more about what works and doesn't work and try to integrate interventions that have been found to work, that are, especially those that are brief and are not work intensive and that can be used in clinics that are hectic. They're there alongside of our giving people antiretrovirals to reduce their viral load and thus their risk of transmitting the virus to others. We should be aware of some of these other behavioral practices too, and screening for STDs, which probably we don't do enough of. In our clinic, we're checking an RPR every year now on people, along with a hepatitis C antibody test, because we're seeing so much syphilis here in the South. People have to be aware of the role of STDs, and I think this section lays out very nicely that we should be cognizant of that. These are guidelines. They give a lot of information that people have to take home and think about. Hopefully, some people will look at this and say, I should go to this website and I should understand more about brief interventions that can be delivered in clinic to help people change their behavior, especially with my particular patient population, and look at, should I be testing more people for STDs? Should I be talking to people more about this? Let's look at what works and what doesn't work. Guidelines can point you in the right direction. I think this is a section that hopefully over time will increase and may not even be at the end.
There's a note stating that for 2 weeks after an update to the guidelines, which was December 1st, so around the 15th, the public can submit comments to the panel. Are there a lot of people who do this?
I think that in many ways it's been such a privilege to be part of being on a panel, and anyone who's been on any sort of guideline committee, whether it be your local infection control committee or your P&T committee at your hospital or a guideline panel such as this, it's really a wonderful opportunity to see how people think and work together. And I think that all of us who work collaboratively see that. And it's also nice that we work, most of us, in a fairly democratic way. I think that feedback is incredibly important for all of us. And another beautiful thing beyond the creativity that we see within HIV medicine is the advocacy. People are passionate about what they do in HIV. It's just wonderful to see that within our treating community. I really do agree with you that the voice of people who have feelings about the guidelines, it's important that those voices be heard, whether they be, thank you very much for doing such a complete job, or I take issue with this one thing, or this is what I'm thinking about, or here's a suggestion how you can make this better. There's a lot of really, really intelligent, thoughtful people taking care of HIV in our country, and that's why we're doing such a great job treating HIV among the patients who come to our clinics. I think you're right, and I'm glad you mentioned it. I know that many of us who do all sorts of work want to hear about how well we're doing, so I would encourage people to certainly respond and let people know what they think about these particular guidelines and anything they think about in the future that should be changed.
Great. Well, I'm afraid we've come to the end of our time talking together. Thank you so much, Dr. Wolf, for taking the time to talk with me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Bonnie.
This has been a news report from thebodypro.com. The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us at news@thebodypro.com.